Ira had been divorced 6 months and still couldn't get his wedding ring off. His finger had swelled dully around it, a combination of frustrated desire, unmitigated remorse, and misdirected ambition, he said to friends. I'm going to have my entire finger surgically removed. The ring, supposedly gold, though now that everything he had ever received from Marilyn had been thrown into doubt, who knew, cinched the blousy fat of his finger, which had grown around it like a happy vine. Maybe I should cut off the whole hand and send it to her, he said on the phone to his friend Mike, with whom he worked at the State Historical Society. She'll understand the reference. Ira had already ceremoniously set fire to his wedding tux, hanging it on a tall stick in his backyard, scarecrow style, and igniting it with a big lighter. That sucker went up really fast, he gasped apologetically to the fire marshal, after the hedge caught too, and before he was brought overnight to the local lockdown facility. So fast, maybe it was, I don't know, like the residual dry cleaning fluid. You'll remove that ring when you're ready, Mike said now. Mike's job, approving historical preservation projects on old houses, left him time to take a lot of lenient parenting courses and to read all the lenient parenting books. Here's what you do for your depression. I'm not going to say lose yourself in charity work. I'm not going to say get some perspective by watching our country's news each evening and by contemplating those worse off than yourself, those, say, who are about to be blown apart by bombs. I'm going to say this. Stop drinking, stop smoking, eliminate coffee, sugar, dairy products. Do this for 3 days and start everything back up again. Bam! I guarantee you, you will be so happy. I'm afraid, Ira said softly, that the only thing that would make me happy right now is snipping the brake cables on Marilyn's car.
That is great. Lori, how would you describe Ira, the main character in this story, debarking?
Ira, how would I describe him? Oh, he's a bit hapless, isn't he? And he's in a state of high anxiety, and he really falls for someone who's really... All wrong for him, but she's beautiful, and so he can't help himself. So he just falls for her and then has to extricate himself. So,
now, there are some recurring themes in this new collection of stories, particularly the difficulties of finding love and holding on to a relationship, especially in middle age. And I have to say, they tend not to work out very well in your stories. And is it fair to say that most of your characters have trouble with relationships?
I think it's fair to say that most characters in everybody's fiction have trouble with relationships. I can't think of a single writer who writes about characters who have no trouble, whether you're talking about Flaubert or Tolstoy or John Updike or whomever you want to talk about. That's just where the stories are. That's part of what life is, and that's the part of life that prompts a lot of stories and storytelling.
Is there a particularly modern way of approaching some of these questions?
No, I think one approaches them from any number of points of view. You know, Henry James did that a lot. He would take a triangle. He was big on triangles, and he would write one novel from the point of view of one part of the triangle, and then write another novel from the point of view of another part of the triangle, and he'd switch things around and have different outcomes, ask different questions, get different answers. But this is, you know, it's the stuff of life, and it's what we all talk about, and it's what writers write about.
Now, you also have a ghost story.
I do have
collection,
a ghost story.
Juniper Tree, in which your narrator visits a friend who has just died, but it turns out the dead woman is still kind of hanging around telling the narrator things she really doesn't want to hear, how she has come up short in her own life. What made you want to write a ghost story?
Well, a friend of mine had actually died, and I had a dream about her that was so vivid that it was like a visitation. And I said to someone the next day, do you think there's such a thing as dead people actually visiting you in your sleep? Or does that sound insane? He said, it does sound insane. You mustn't tell anyone. But he said he had the same experience, and that many people do. I mean, you can have dreams that are so vivid, you just think, that's not really a dream.
I had one of those, too.
You did?
Yeah.
With someone who had died?
With my grandmother, right after she died.
See? Yeah. I think there's a way in which, I don't know, the dream self can access some other, I don't know. Now I'm going to stop talking because I will sound crazy. So the vividness of the dream prompted me to write this story. It's not a transcription of the dream, but it's very much prompted by the dream.
Is this fertile ground for you as a writer to
dreams?
Ghost stories.
Well, I have taken to telling my students to put a ghost in their stories because, you know, it's a time-tested element in literature. You know, Shakespeare did it. Dickens did it. Ghosts are great. James did it. Literature's full of ghosts, and they can do a lot of interesting storytelling work, psychological work.
But a lot of those ghosts in fiction, like, you know, Henry James, they're kind of horror stories. Yours is not that way.
Well, I don't think it is, but some people have said it's quite gruesome, and they do find it a little scary. But, I mean, it depends. I suppose you could have a funny ghost story, too. I mean, mm-hmm. I think Bill Murray was in one or something. I don't know. But I think you use a ghost for whatever purposes you use it. But in this story, the ghost is sort of a figure of rebuke for the narrator of the story, who has a little bit of both grief and remorse and guilt to cope with.
And the ghost is there to remind her
to
about
remind
all
her
of those things.
Right. To rebuke her slightly, yes. gently.
And are there more ghost stories in your future then?
Oh, I don't know. Possibly. I don't know.
I want to also talk about another one of the stories in this collection, Wings, the longest story.
That actually has a couple ghosts in it too at the end. Just mentioned very briefly. Yeah. They don't get any lines. But they're sort of glimpsed on the stairs, I think. Unless they took that part out, I have to read.
No, this is about a couple in their late 30s, musicians who were together in a band. The band didn't work out. It sounds like they were not terribly good musicians. They're barely scraping by. What was the idea for this story?
Well, that was prompted somewhat. I mean, I lifted a very basic plot element from Wings of the Dove. It's been used by other storytellers before. And again, you know, it's a triangle. But I wanted also to have a couple who would realistically be both interesting and appealing and also morally murky and have them somehow target this old man.
This old man who is nearing the end of his life, and the question is, does he have money, and might he leave some of it to them?
Right. And that's the story of Wings of the Dove, although in Wings of the Dove, the couple is going after a dying young American girl. In this case, it's different. But I was interested in Casey, in that girl, who is not really the Kate Croy figure in Wings of the Dove. She's really the Densher figure, who begins to do the dirty work and then doesn't care for that, and all the love between the couple is lost and broken, and the affections between in the new relationship start to become a little bit real.
The relationship with the old man.
Yeah. Although the end's a little different from the James novel, but whatever.
Could you read a passage from that story? And I was thinking about a passage where Casey, your narrator, is reflecting on her relationship with her boyfriend, Dench, who's pretty much of a deadbeat. And I was thinking of page 111.
"Here's your coffee," she said to Dench, who was still in bed. "Yum, tepid backwash. Hey, don't complain," she said. "You can go next time and bring me back half." "I'm not complaining," he said in a sleepy stretch. "But it's like you took longer this time." She took a brush sharply to her scalp and began brushing. If she waited longer with her hair, she might get 1,200. She threw it back and arched from her waist. Only in the mirror could she see her Decatur tattoo, put there one night in linotype, got harder in the crook of her neck when they were playing in Decatur, and she wanted to be reminded never to play there again. That's a strange way to be reminded, Dench had said, and Casey had said, what better? Was there a big line at the coffee shop? Dench asked, smacking his lips. No, I stopped and talked to some guy. Cat is going up every driveway that ever had a squirrel or rabbit dash over it. Some guy? Geezer. Hey, this backwash is good, he said. There's something new in it. Were you wearing cherry chapstick or something? Have you noticed that there are a lot of people with money around here? She asked. We should meet them, he said. We need producers. You go meet them, she said. She would look up Guillotine on the internet on her next trip to the library. You're cuter, said Dench. Of course, time is of the essence in these matters. She loved Dench. She was helpless before the whole emotional project of him, but it didn't preclude hating him and everything around him, which included herself, the sound of her own voice, and the sound of his, which was worse. The portraits of Hal never ceased, and sometimes were done up in raucous gilded frames to console. Romantic hope. From where did women get it? Certainly not from men who were walking caveat emptors. No, women got it from other women, because in the end, women would rather be rid of one another than have to endure themselves on a daily basis. So they urged each other into relationships. He loves you. You can see it in his eyes, they lied.
Now, one of the trademarks of your writing, and something you're famous for, is the way you manage to combine both funny and awful. Sometimes in the same paragraph, even the same sentence, you know, sort of looking for the humor in our anxiety, our misery. And I guess I'm wondering if that's sort of the way you often see the world, you know, in daily life, or is that more of a writerly sensibility?
I don't know. I think it's the way the world is. And so if it's not the way the world is, then it is the way I see the world, I guess. You know, the stories are not without their sort of humorless moments, too. And sometimes the world is like that. But there's a lot of absurdity, and there's a lot of funny stuff surrounding really, really hard and difficult and sad stuff. And it's just there, and it's up to you whether you want to take note of it or not. I guess it's a sensibility, but yeah. It's also a fact of life.
Now, if we step back from your stories for a moment and just talk about the art of the short story in general, what do you think makes a really good short story?
You know, many things. I think the short story is such a limber and varied form that you can look at any number of stories that are very, very different and have very different qualities and elements, and they can all be good. So the primary thing is, of course, that you give the reader an experience of something. And it probably should be a psychological experience, an experience that has both intelligence and emotion in it. And the story probably should have a voice. But those are very general ideas. And when you look at the short story, when you look at Flannery O'Connor or Donald Bartlemy, they are doing very, very different things. But they are still giving the reader an experience, and they are both writing really, really well.
Do you think that experience is different than reading a novel?
Well, it's a briefer experience, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's an experience that has to happen in one sitting. You know, a novel, you keep going back. You can read 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, 2 hours there. A story has to be read in a single sitting from beginning to end. So in that way, it's different from a novel. I mean, it really requires a good half hour to 45 minutes from a reader, and that's not always available for readers. So the idea that short stories are good for short attention spans is really not true. Novels are better for short attention spans because you can just duck in and out and do other things. But a short story really requires the attention of a reader for a sustained amount of time, not a huge amount of time, but different stories require different things. I mean, Alice Munro has stories that are 60 pages, so you will read, and, you know, it might take over an hour.
And she somehow manages to compress what almost feels like a novel
into
a short story. I don't know how she does it, but...
Well, I think she does it by starting to write a novel. I mean, she has said that so many of her stories started out as novels. She thought they would be novels, and she got to page 60, and they were done.
And as far as I know, she never wrote a novel.
Well, it depends what you call a novel. I mean, you know, Lives of Girls and Women has the same character running through all the stories. It's linked stories placed sequentially. You could call that a novel. And I think in the UK they called that a novel and actually put it up for the Booker Prize at one point. And then there's The Beggar Maid, which also has the same stories running through, same characters running through the stories, and the stories are arranged chronologically.
Hmm. You have written both short stories and novels. Is it a different, do you approach them differently? I mean, other than the fact that one is a lot longer than the other, but is that, do you think about them differently?
One takes years, and one you hope will only take a week and usually takes months. So they are very different in that way, at least for me. I mean, D.H. Lawrence, I think, said once any writer worth his salt can write a novel in 6 weeks, but I'm not one of those.
Now, you had said that one should read a short story in one sitting. Does that translate to writing as well?
Well, you can't go through all the drafts in a single sitting, but at some point you should. I mean, if you could get a draft out in a single sitting, that would be perfect. But at some point you have to go through your short story and see it completely as somebody would who's reading it in a single sitting. You have to feel the whole arc of it and the experience of it. Now, you will never be able to read a novel that way. You won't be able to know where a reader's going to stop and pick up again. And so you can never sit down and read your novel the way a reader's going to read it. You won't know. But you have to be able to do that with a short story, and so you want to write to that effect the best you can.
Now, when you're working on a short story, do you tend to sketch out the arc of the story in one sitting and in your first sitting?
In my mind, sure. And I usually write the beginning, and then I write the end, and then I write the middle last. So I have a sense of its parameters and a sense of its shape. And I'm usually trying to respond fairly quickly to something, although, of course, it takes much longer than I would like.
Now, this seems to be a wonderful moment in short stories now.
Oh,
I mean, there are all these great short story writers out there.
Right.
More so, I would guess, than 20 years ago, maybe? I don't know.
I don't know about more so than 20 years ago, but more so than 100 years ago. Absolutely. I think right now North America kind of owns the short story, and it's been nourished in any number of ways. You know, Canada has Alice Munro, and up until last month had Mavis Gallant. And the United States has had a lot of people who have had their short stories sort of supported, nourished, encouraged by university life, MFA programs, writing programs, and a culture of small journals and larger journals too that have been devoted to publishing short stories. Now, the commercial aspect of short stories is mostly gone, but that has sort of purified it, I think. I've said this before. I mean, it used to be, you know, Fitzgerald could publish a story in the 30s in Redbook for $15,000, which is the equivalent of like $250,000 or something.
Wow.
I mean, it's a lot of money. It's the same as writing a TV script or something, or it's much more than that, actually. But those days are gone. I mean, short stories used to be a way for novelists to fund their novels, and that's what Fitzgerald did. But now that's gone, and people are really devoted to short stories as an art, a literary art form in and of itself. And there's just beautiful examples of it everywhere in the last 100 years.
It's so interesting to hear you say that North America pretty much owns the short story, coming back to the MFA programs.
Right.
There's this ongoing debate. What do MFA programs do to the quality of writing, and, you know, sort of the MFA program versus the more commercial style of publishing? I mean, obviously, you've taught in writing programs for years. It sounds like you're saying that overall that has been a good thing for our literature.
It absolutely has been. It doesn't affect the nature of the short story itself. It helps the writer write the story. It helps the stories to occur. And so when you have this tremendous abundance that has been supported and encouraged, you end up having a higher quality, you know. Quantity, to some extent, will yield quality. And it allows people who have no other way to sit down and get writing done to do that, to take 2 years of their lives and write. And that's a beautiful thing. You know, it used to be the Russian short story in the 19th century was the great, great short story, you know, world, I think. But right now, it's really happening in North America. I don't think anyone can argue with that.
Do you have a preference, writing short stories or novels?
I don't know. You know, I've written more short stories than novels, but my last book before this one was a novel. And I got very fond of the narrator, and I was really reluctant to let her go. And she sat on my desk for years. And then when I turned it all in, knowing that there were still problems and all, I found I missed her so much. And I thought, that's really crazy. And so that kind of intense relationship with the world of a novel and with a character in it is something that you don't quite have with short stories. Short stories, you assemble a cast of characters and then you get rid of them. After 20 pages, they are gone, or 40.
Now, I want to talk about another kind of narrative as well, because you have written some wonderful essays about television for the New York Review of Books, especially about particularly acclaimed TV series like The Wire and Friday Night Lights and Homeland. And I want to ask you about this because there is a lot of talk these days that we are now in a golden age of television, especially with these long-running series that have shown up on cable TV. And some people have been very explicit about drawing the connection. I mean, have been basically saying this is the equivalent of what the novel used to be.
Well, I think there's a lot of justification for that, it seems to me. I am not an expert on television. How I started writing about television is rather fluky. I mostly have done book reviews for the New York Review of Books, but I had heard so much about The Wire, and then I sat down one summer and just watched it all, and it was amazing to me. I didn't watch it when it was on, so I just had watched it through Netflix. It had already been, you know, canceled. It was gone from HBO already.
I read somewhere that you watched all 5 seasons in just a few days.
Maybe. It's 60 that's a
lot
hours.
That's a lot of TV in
it
a
was,
short amount of
it
time.
It was 60 hours. I think my son was at summer camp. I couldn't stop. It was a little bit of a binge. But that's how one reads a novel. You know, and so it has that, you know, resemblance to a novel in that way as well. The experience of it, not just the depth of the story itself, but also the nature of how a viewer goes about experiencing the narrative. So at any rate, I watched this, and then I wanted to read what other people had written about The Wire. And I went online, and I went to The New Yorker. Nothing. The New Yorker had not written a thing. I went to the New York Times. They had written a tiny little inch-long thing. I went to the New York Review of Books. Nothing. But the London cultural press was all over The Wire. The London Review of Books and the London Times had written about it. So I said to Bob Silvers, I said, you want a piece on The Wire? I know it's kind of years late, but you've never, you know, published anything. And he's very open, lovely man. And he said, sure. And so that's how I got started with TV writing. But I was not real. I mean, TV writing about television. I'm really just brought in like someone who knows nothing about television. And this is what I have to say.
But you bring your literary sensibility to looking at television.
I bring whatever I have. But it's not any sort of expertise. It's just, this is what I think I'm seeing. Now, the quality of the acting is enormous. These actors right now, the depth of talent is just extraordinary. The slowness with which one is able to film and the leisureliness with which an actor can sort of interpret a particular moment is new, I think, to television, and it's on cable. You know, when you look at television from our childhoods, you know, in the 60s, it's all very fast. It's all a little sticky.
And there wasn't really progression from one episode to the next.
There wasn't that, but it was also fast. And the comedies were all sort of drawn from vaudeville, I think. And they, you know, and then the dramas were full of cliches. So these new dramas, and a lot of them are police procedurals, so they're following in the footsteps of other police procedurals, but they're going more slowly. I think the Helen Mirren, now I'm blanking on the
Prime
name.
Suspect.
Prime Suspect. I think that was an early example, the BBC series, of what these other series have really tried to do.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that these really good TV series have basically taken some of the conventions of the novel, developing a narrative arc that can go for a long period of time where the characters actually change. I mean, they grow, they develop, which is not traditionally what has happened in television, but that is what novels do.
Right. Well, they have more space. They have, and if you give a director and a cast and a bunch of screenwriters a lot of space and you say, you don't have to stop for a commercial every 5 minutes, you don't have to stop at all, you know, then you're in a beautiful place that's even better than making a film. And so you have these novelistic television series.
Well, I know David Simon, the creator of The Wire, has said that he regarded his series as not television, but as a novel.
Yes, I know.
Which is sort of an odd thing to say.
But it's true. It's true. because it doesn't resemble television, really. I mean, it doesn't resemble the television that he grew up on, at any rate. It might bear some resemblance to Prime Suspect, which also took on a lot of social issues in London and went at a more leisurely pace and had seasons and I don't know, and had lovely, lovely acting all the way through. But no, I have great respect for these long-form cable narratives now. They're really, although someone's telling me that True Detective is really great, but I haven't had time to watch it. Have you watched it?
I have not, no. Oh. Well, I have to ask you about the question that was posed just very recently in the New York Times book review, basically asking, is this new golden age of television, is it the new novel? Which raises all kinds of interesting questions. I mean, is it sort of doing what novels traditionally have done? Is it replacing what people have traditionally gotten from novels? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think that one needs to replace the other. There is a way in which when you read and come in contact with a single mind that is working very hard to burn its story onto a page, that is its own experience. It's the solitude of it, the speaking of just one person to another, that will always be unique.
And it would seem that the thing that television, no matter how good, will never be able to do is to really get inside the head of someone.
Right.
I mean, to really explore the nature of human
consciousness.
Right,
and it will always be a collaborative art form. But as collaborative art forms go, this long-form narrative cable storytelling has gotten very good. But it's still collaborative. I mean, you go to reading for something that's not that. That's one solitude speaking to another solitude. You know, you go to it for that.
So that's interesting. So partly what you want from the experience of writing fiction is to encounter the mind of the author.
Well, you want to encounter the mind of the story, which the author has made. But each story may have a slightly different mind. But yeah, it's the mind of the story, and it's just one mind. And it's organized, its characters, and it's speaking and using language on the page in a certain way. And the mind of the story, of course, is behind the mind of the story is the mind of the author. So in that way, it's collaborative, but it's not collaborative in a real way.
Has your thinking about television, watching this really high-quality television, has this affected at all the way you think about your writing?
No. You know, I really don't watch much television. In fact, I don't think I've watched any television in about a year. I don't really feel that it's affected things at all, although it's affected my cable bill, because I didn't used to bother to have HBO, so now I do.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of whether television now, I mean, this golden age of television is affecting the literary landscape in any way? I mean, do you see fiction writers respond, sort of writing in a different way because of what television is now doing?
Well, you know, probably one was always seeing writers be affected by television, be affected by whatever was in their lives or in the culture. But I don't see that. I don't see people, although I don't, as I said, I don't watch enough television maybe to know or to recognize. Maybe my students are writing things that are straight out of Saturday Night Live skits. I don't know. I don't watch Saturday Night Live. So I'm not a very devoted television watcher, which is why when I've gone to write about it, I'm really writing as a Martian, you know, from Mars. I assume that's why I'm invited to do it, that they want the Martian viewpoint.
This has been great. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.